What is your theory about what happened to this plane? Where is it now and who's responsible? Joining us now, Michael Kay. He's got a huge military background, flying experience, and sat on two crash investigations on the Board of Inquiry, former UK Ministry of Defense advisor, and you see him all over Fox News. Hey, Michael, welcome.
Brian, good morning, and good to see you again.
Michael, what changed about this investigation from when you first heard it to where we are now, and where should the focus be?
I think that's a pivotal question, Brian. I think everyone should be asking that, because it has changed. You're absolutely right. When I first heard about the Malaysian airline disappearing, to me, I couldn't help but look at history, and specifically the Air France 447 flight, because conspiracy theory is great, and I know we all have to be aware of what Al-Qaeda are up to in the world, and we can never forget, obviously, what happened at 9-11, and that's very important to be cognizant of what happened on 9-11 and never to let that happen again. I'll come on to that in a second. But I'm also a realist, and having been part of two boards of inquiry, we have to consider every aspect of what the potential conclusion could have been. Now, the Air France 447 flight, the black box wasn't found until 2 years after the incident happened. That's a significant amount of time. And what happened was, you've got ice in the pitot tube. The pitot tube is this this little aluminium tube on the outside of the cockpit that feeds dynamic pressure into the airspeed indicator. The airspeed indicator ceases functioning as something that gives you airspeed and then starts to work like an altimeter. So what happens is, as the aircraft climbs, it shows an increase in speed, which doesn't happen. So what the pilots did was, they brought the power back. As they were bringing the power back, the aircraft was climbing because they thought the aircraft was speeding up. It entered a catastrophic stall, which is basically a catastrophic loss of lift on the wing, and then the aircraft descended into the ocean. The pilots weren't aware that this was going on, which is why we didn't get a distress call. It's why we didn't get 7700 on the transponder. And this is sort of the kind of similar situation in the first sort of 24, 48 hours. And then we learn that the transponder has been turned off while simultaneously the aircraft is rechanging direction 140 degrees, heading over the Malacca Strait. And that, for me, then was the introduction of something a little bit more sinister, a little bit more foul play. And that sort of opened my eyes and started me going down the routes of hijack versus sabotage.
I get the sense that we're starting to pile on the pilot, because evidently he was divorced from his wife, but his wife and kids left the house. He was upset that his favorite candidate was going to jail. He went to the court trial. He was a little upset there. And we see him on an obsession with aviation. As a pilot, not that unusual. The fact that he built his own simulator, somewhat unusual. So we think he's competent as a pilot, passionate about flying. But I don't know if this adds up into death by a suicide mission.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there, actually, Brian. I think it's right to look. I mean, it's absolutely right and proper. This is a criminal investigation now, because we don't know where the wreckage is. So I think it's absolutely right and proper to investigate the two key individuals, the co-pilot and the training captain, accordingly, just to try and understand, you know, what the political backgrounds might be and whether there are any might be sort of subversive agendas. So I think that's right. But I also agree that when you look at the events that we know, and I like to try and concentrate on facts. You know, we know that the ACARS was tampered with, and the ACARS comes in two pieces.
What's an ACAR again?
The ACARS is the Aircraft Communication Address Reporting System. So what it is it's basically something by Boeing that transmits data on the engine engines and the fuselage of the aircraft as it's going through its journey. So the airline can get a heads up on, you know, fuel burns, engine temperatures, and it knows what engineering assistance to give the aircraft on the ground before it arrives on the ground. So it's designed to increase efficiency, if you like, of the airline. Now, this has an ability to transmit messages. So it's got an information side and it's got a transmission side. The information side, if you bury into what's called an MFD, a multifunctional display in the cockpit, can be turned off in the cockpit. But the transmission side can't be turned off in the cockpit. You have to go under the cockpit door into the electric bay, and you can only turn it off there. It wasn't turned off completely, which is why we've got these 4 to 5 pings every hour, 4 to 5 hours after the transponder was turned off.
Maybe I missed something. I thought the pings were coming from the engines. You're saying that it was because the transponder wasn't totally turned off?
No, it's not the transponder, it's the ACARS. There's two elements to the ACARS. There's the information aspect on the ACARS, which sends the messages. That can be turned off in the cockpit. But then there's the actual ACARS itself, which sends out pings to the Inmarsat satellite. And that can't be turned off unless you go into the electrical bay, and it wasn't turned off, which is why we got these pings from the ACAR system 4 to 5 hours after the transponder was turned off. So it's not the transponder, it's the ACAR system.
Gotcha. So a lot of people are saying, wait a second, let's look at who was on that flight. And amongst the passengers was another pilot. Amongst the passengers were two people we know at least with fake passports who immediately were eliminated because they were looking for asylum. Would you eliminate them?
I never eliminate anyone in the broad context of the investigation. But two of the key things that we need to ask ourselves is that if this was going to be a terrorist act in any way, what are the motives? And how would they be looking to actually get the attention that, you know, a terrorist act usually gets? So, for example, in 9/11, the ends was a suicide attack, and that was to shock and awe. Now, you know, one of the principles of war for me is surprise, and surprise, you know, is all about creating confusion in the unexpected. Now, I think where we're at the moment is that. If this was going to be a suicide mission, then it kind of hasn't been that successful. And to what aims, sort of what political aims would that have achieved? The other aspect is that you take it somewhere, you land it, you have, you know, 239 hostages, and then you use those as leverage against, you know, a government or a political entity for hostage release transport or something along those lines. But to me, that doesn't seem like a viable outcome either. I mean, there's a lot of people, Brian, talking about where this jet could be if indeed it has landed somewhere. And for me, it's 90% going to be in the Indian Ocean because, you know, what I talked about the other day on Judge Jeanine is that there are, post 9/11, there are a lot of now sophisticated integrated air defense systems such as, you know, Pakistan and India, that they have these systems to detect blips crossing their sovereign territory so they can alert their quick reaction alert fighters to get up there and investigate what the blip might be. Now, if we go back to the Osama bin Laden raid, we know the Chinooks had crossed the Afghan border at very low level. That's the job that I used to do. And we keep at low level, we used to keep at low level, below 100 feet to avoid enemy radar. We know that about 10 minutes getting into Pakistan airspace, we know that they were detected and a couple of F-16s were launched during that raid. That is a well-known fact. So the systems of detecting a 777 heading north up into, you know, the Pakistan region, I just don't think that is a viable option. And likewise, heading south, if it headed south, it would have to cross Indonesia. Indonesia do have a framework for alerting themselves to unidentified aircraft in their region without a transponder. So for me, the obvious area is west.
Interesting. Well, everyone else is looking north-south. Michael Kay is looking west. So we'll see. I mean, Michael, the other thing is, if a terrorist objective was to take a plane, they needed a plane for whatever their goals were, would they need to steal it like this? Couldn't it be a less theatrical way to steal a plane?
I go back to sort of the element of surprise. I mean, a lot of people, Brian, are talking about a lot of analysts are talking about sort of being a dry run. But to me, if it is a dry run and it is being hidden somewhere, you've lost that element of surprise already because people now are already going to be on a higher alert. The CIA, the FBI, sovereign territories in the area are going to be on a higher alert. The military installations, the radar installation is going to be a higher alert, looking for an unidentified object that could potentially be used in some sort of spectacular event. So if they are going along, if it has been a terrorist act and they are looking to do a spectacular, they've lost the element of surprise already, which would seem, you know, which would seem strange to me. Because if you look at 9/11, it was the sinisterness of it was genius. I mean, it was an awful tragedy, but it was genius because it took everyone by surprise. No one in their wildest dreams expected an attack of that nature. And I think that's what terrorist organizations, the Al-Qaeda's of this world, have to be thinking along the lines of now, is they have to be doing something that sovereign territories in the West and the security and the intelligence services just wouldn't even be thinking of.
Wow.
So I think if it has been taken somewhere, I think they've lost or are starting to lose the element of surprise aspect.
Yeah, they're spray painting it somewhere if it's still around and those people are okay.
well,
we hope
yeah.
That's the scenario. Michael Kay, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Great to speak to you again, buddy.
Right. You got to see Michael Kay, too. I mean, he's 6'7", about 250. This guy can do some damage.